This is Spectrum.
Alternative Myth, Homeopathy, Secret Society, Hypnosis, The Paranormal, Alternative Energy, UFO Abduction, The Weird, The Wild, and The Wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, welcome to Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. I'm Scott Jordan here with my co-host, Tom Theopenis, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Hey, Tom.
Hey, how you doing? How are you?
I'm doing good. It's been a little crazy with all the technical problems and computer crashing and had my computer in parts all over the floor, but I think I got it figured out. And just the other night, during our interview with Foster Gamble, talking about Thrive, our website crashed, and the buttons on our BBS radio site took people to stream one. Nobody could go and listen to that show on the internet on the night of the interview. So it's all up in the archive section, and so knock yourself out, guys. Anyway, we've got a really good guest tonight. I've been looking forward to him. Read all of his writings and watched many interviews with him. Could you tell us who it is?
Yes, I could. Well, tonight's guest is Daniel Brinkley, who's the author of the international bestseller Saved by the Light and A Peace in the Light. He has appeared on hundreds of television and radio shows. In 1994, his New York Times bestseller Saved by the Light was the highest-rated made-for-television movie of all time. Daniel is loved and respected worldwide for his inspirational lectures on the near-death experiences, palliative and hospice care, complementary and alternative healing practices, and self-awareness. Having survived numerous brushes with death, Daniel is the expert in the dying process. He was twice struck by lightning and has since survived heart failure, open-heart surgery, ruptured subdural hematomas, brain surgery, and a massive seizure. So let's welcome Damien to our show. Hi, Damien.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Scotty.
Hi, Damien. I think that bio must be a little old because you've written a third book called Secrets of the Light.
Absolutely, and it was a terrific seller also.
Yeah.
And now I'm writing a new book at the present called 10 Things You Need to Know Before You Go.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Don't you see, when you spend as much time exploring what we call death, you develop a relationship with this process that becomes not only friendly, but it becomes appreciative. And as people think about getting older, and the more frightening it becomes because we live in such fear of this process, that I needed to let people know that if you deal with these issues that I've heard people talk about at end of life, they can back engineer their life and really live this life, which is a great and rare opportunity. The fact that you come to this particular dimension and you live, for a woman it's about 76.4 years, and for the man, it's about 72.4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. So with that as an average lifespan, you have to understand what a rare privilege it is to come here and to be alive at this particular time, at this particular dimensional reality.
Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. And you just last year, or beginning of this year, didn't you get the Lifetime Achievement Award presented to you by George Norrie?
Right. Coast to Coast.
Yeah. And that was the Coast to Coast Lifetime Achievement Award. Brilliant. Yeah. Absolutely brilliant. Because I remember your early interviews with Art Bell. I mean, I was listening to Art Bell when he was just starting out. And he was
1994.
Yeah, live. Yep. And then he eventually got live stream on the internet, and it was, you know, it was a brilliant show, and I loved Art. I just loved him to death. I think very few broadcasters make it to his level. There are some, but I put him on a pedestal.
Well, but you know, art was like, art was a rare breed. Art is different from George Norrie, but art
well,
reached
I like
the,
George.
Oh, no, I like George a lot.
Yeah.
They're completely different. Mm-hmm. Art was, art never believed anything. Okay,
yeah.
And George has a tendency to believe those things because
exactly.
You, art would give you just enough rope to set yourself up, whereas George gives you enough expanse to truly bring your audience into at least the opportunity to understand, whereas art was mostly interested in letting you talk yourself into a trap, which is what makes him a great interviewer, but it also makes him both different.
Yeah.
I like the fact that I have gone through both periods.
Yeah, that's true.
I remember Art from Art and I and Ramona were very, very good friends. And they were friends of my wife, Catherine, and we spent a lot of time with them. And I can remember when in 1997, when I had to have brain surgery, Art took a photograph of me dead, and he always kept it around and made fun of it because my eyes were fixed and dilated when I came out of the brain surgery just before I had the subdural, before I had the grand mal seizure, and he would always show this picture to me, and he's a funny character.
Yeah, but yeah. George, I mean, you could tell that Art loved you.
But we developed such a close friendship. I mean, Art came and did his show from Charleston when I was in the hospital because they gave me an 8% chance of survival.
Yeah.
But they've been giving me that kind of chance of survival about every 5 or 6 months for the last 35 years. So, you know, who pays any attention?
Okay. Okay, this is interesting. I want to know what sort of person were you in your early life, in your early 20s, that the universe felt that it needed to kill you multiple times?
I was an asshole.
Uh-oh.
No, we're not supposed to use our excuse me.
No, you can say anything you want. This is internet radio.
This is what I was. I grew up as a tough guy. I grew up as a little kid, and I thought the way you dealt with anything is you hit it in the face first. Then you explored whatever point of perspective. And then when I got into my teens, I discovered that if you shoot the first one, everybody else listened to you when you talked to them. Then I discovered the United States Marine Corps, and my life was fulfilled. Mm. And I grew up in fundamentalism in South Carolina, and as most of you know, everybody goes to hell in South Carolina.
Yep.
So when I grew up in fundamentalism, I rejected it. It didn't make sense to me at 10 years old that there was this God that if I didn't love this God, I was going to hell. Well, about 11 years old, I came to the conclusion that if you thought you could scare me into loving you, then wherever hell was going to be an interesting place. Because your love is the only thing you really have. It's the only thing that really belongs to you. It's the only thing that you can measure by a deep emotion. And it's not something that you can control. And it's not something that you can give to someone or something without it moving deeply into your spiritual self. And I thought about it a lot. So I think a lot of rejecting present-day fundamentalism was a driver in becoming a brute. And I will have to admit, growing up, I was skilled as a brute. I was a good fighter, and I was pretty cunning at destruction. And I would time the destruction of things, but when you get struck by lightning and you lift out of your body and you see that nothing in the world that you ever believed was really real, you go down a tunnel and you come into a place of bright, brilliant, beautiful light and you see the absolute wonders of what the heavens are like. And people say, why do you say heavens? Well, in Genesis, it says there are seven. Mm-hmm. So I believe that now. But when you come to this place, the most staggering point that everybody has to come to realize, Scotty and Tommy, is this. You will have a panoramic life review. No matter what else goes on about this near-death business, and no matter how much ballyhoo everybody says and blah, 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 what you're going to have is a panoramic life review. And what that means is you're going to see your entire life pass before you in a 360-degree panorama. You will have missed nothing. You know how many hairs was in the nose of the doctor who pulled you from your mother. You know every label. You know every license plate, every tree, what kind of tree it was. You know the every person that's in the room. As you walk out of that hospital in your mom's arms to get in the car to go home, you will know everything that was there. How many leaves were on the trees? How many hairs was on the head of everybody around you? What is so amazing to me now, if you think you're a know-it-all now, wait till you're dead. And you realize that you know everything. You have missed nothing. Amen. So when you see your whole life pass before you in this 360-degree panorama, you get a grip. You get a grip that you are capable of conceiving and perceiving everything that exists. Then you watch it from a second-person point of view, as though you were your best friend looking at the choices that you have made. Not that you've made wrong choices, because the universe doesn't measure things in right or wrong, good or evil, day or night, dark or light, bad or good. It measures on based on the life's purpose that you chose and what you chose to achieve, the options that you've taken. So when we wrote Secrets of the Light, it was really driven by the second part of the panoramic life review. Because the fourfold path in Secrets of the Light, everything's about love. Second, what you believe about your love, belief. Third, choices. And then the way to create a better life, what I call prayer, defined as willful conscious intent. But you will watch your life from a second person point of view as if you were a friend. And you'll be amazed at how often you say, wow, that was really smart. But you, in my particular case, you'll be even more amazed than when you say, wow, what were you thinking, you complete idiot? Then what happens is you watch yourself become every person that you have ever encountered. And you will feel the direct results of your interaction between you and everyone else. I think this was the point that was the most transformative for me. When I realized that I was going to be every person that I'd ever encountered, and I was going to feel the direct results of my interaction, what it did was change my intent in my actions. No matter what else have happened, and you know, I have had some pretty phenomenal near-death experiences because I don't ever seem to really get it, so every 10 to 12 years they kill me just to make sure I don't mess up. And I think it's because I'm like one of the most famous dead guys. So, you know, we got to keep Daniel straight. So we need to kill him again. You know, that just shows what a fool I am. But when you become every person that you ever encounter and you feel the direct results of your interaction between that person, to even hear one person say this would be enough for someone to change. To hear thousands of people now say this should be the single most transformative moment in the life of anyone who believes that they're going to leave this world. And like I said earlier, you know, the number one cause of death in the world is birth. If you were born, you will leave.
Yeah.
And as many people who now are coming forward with the near-death experience, because of what I'm proud of is my story and the work of Raymond Moody and Bruce Grayson and Michael Sabom and Melvin Morris and all the early Ian Stevenson and all the really early Ken Ring and all the really early pioneers of the near-death experience when it was not common practice. You know, they now teach it in medical school. They now teach it in nursing school, how to deal with the near-death experience. And when you start to look at mainstreaming scientific consciousness in medicine, whose fault is it that we keep coming back? The advancements of cardiopulmonary resuscitation techniques, the advancements in how you can get a heart started. In 1975, if you didn't have a pulse or a respiration or brain activity for 5 minutes, you were considered dead. When I got to the hospital in 1975, the admission slip says, patient unconscious, patient not breathing, no EKG. Well, when you're unconscious and you're not breathing and you don't have any heartbeat, and it's been 28 minutes, that was usually a tendency to believe this fool was dead.
Yeah.
Now you can resuscitate someone up to 3 hours because of this kind of technique. And it has to do with hypothermia and how you chill the body down, how you can suspend and chill the heart, how you can keep machines that pump oxygen, that pumps blood through the body and the brain without you being consciousness. You know, these are all creating what we now know as the phenomenon of near-death experiences. But the final point I wanted to make was, after you go through this panoramic life review, you watch it from a second-person point of view, you become every person that you ever encounter. And you feel the direct results of your actions. You become everybody. For that first near-death experience, I didn't have a lot of really good stuff because I was really just a jackass. But I've learned. But then the part that becomes the most imperative perspective, judgment. And this is a Danianism, but because a lot of people say divinity, and a lot of people don't like to use the word God because God is a German word. You know, when you, in the old books you created, you wrote the word G, double-sided pyramid, and then D, and that was the word that was used for God. And when Johann Gutenberg invented the printing press, he didn't invent a double-sided V, a pyramid. He invented a zero, an O. So instead of putting the double-sided pyramid, he put G-O-D as the word representing the divine, and it became God, as opposed to Yahweh or Jehovah or the unknown name, which is 26 letters in Hebrew. So, but the point is this, and everybody better remember this. When you look back at your life, when you leave this world, it'll be this. If God could not come today and God sent you, in the life you just reviewed, what difference did God make? That tells the story, Scott and Tom. You came here to learn to be a co-creator. You came here to separate your identity and to appear to be separate from people so that you could empower them to achieve their spiritual identity and support others. That was the greatest lesson, and it's been the concurrent flow of knowledge that I've had through three of these and 35 years of studying death. And I know, Scotty, you got into the business of near-death experiences, yeah. So you understand.
Yeah, I did a two-year research study on near-death experience. Yeah, of course, I was inspired by all the people that were writing about it at the time, about 18 years ago. And
you could only have been about 8 years old then, so.
Yeah, I wish.
So you wrote this thing in print. You printed it, right?
Well, I'm 47, so it wasn't that long ago. But I really find it interesting that with the tunnel and the experience that people go through, how would you what's your take on ghosts?
Well, it depends on how you prepare them.
Didn't see that one coming, did you?
If you cook them slowly over an open pit and you put a lot of good South Carolina barbecue sauce on them, I will love a ghost. Okay. I never believed, after two near-death experiences and going through this stuff, I never believed in ghosts. I thought it was all bull. Because nothing to do with the near-death experience had I ever encountered what a ghost was. And then in the early years of the Swami business, I began to see, after the second experience with open-heart surgery, after being struck by lightning, then came open-heart surgery, because I began to be around people in transition, and I began hospice work in 1984. I'd never seen a ghost. But in the 90s, after 1989 and open heart surgery, and seeing my mother's sister When my mother passed in 1984, this was the driver. My mother was terrified. And why? When she was a kid, she was a basketball star, and she had a 14-year-old sister named Marion. And mother was 2 years older. She was probably 16. And when you're a big-time basketball star, and they were on the bus going to a game, the basketball team didn't want a younger sister, and my mother didn't want a younger sister there with her. And so my mother was really angry at her and told Marion to get away and go sit in the back of the bus or leave them who were sitting in the front. And she went back toward the back of the bus. The bus hit a bump. The emergency door fell open, and the bus ran over Marion. My mother lived with that fear and that pain and punishment her whole life. And I can remember her talking about it, and it bothered her a lot that she thought that her actions of selfishness are what we all go through as childhood pride and ego and as you're trying to find yourself. And when I was in the room with my mom, and she had Raynaud's disease and lupus, and they had cauterized her lungs because my dad would do anything to keep her here another day. And they didn't have laser beams in those days. They didn't have lasers. They would go in and burn the inside of your lungs. And I came to see my mom, and she was saying, I understand now, because no one understood the near-death experience, and I wasn't talking about it very much in those days. I was still learning. But my mother said, I understand now, and I believe you. And she said, please don't let them hurt me anymore. And I said, you have it. You got it, Mom. So the two little orderlies told me I was going to have to leave the room because she was going into code. And they said, you're going to have to leave now or we're going to have to call security. I said, well, you boys better call the National Guard because she never left me when I needed her, and I will not leave her now that she asked me to stay. Well, they sized me up pretty good, and I knew they were in trouble. And I said, Mom, what has happened? She said, Marion has come. And I looked over my left shoulder, and I could see an image, this silhouetted image, that my mother was talking to her. And I thought, if there was a God anywhere, the person who would come to get my mother, where my mother knew it was safe to let go and leave from this world to the next, there could have been no one better than Marion. Because Mom was forgiven. So in the course now, in 1989, when I had the next near-death experience, I now understand that no one leaves here alone. When you're frightened, someone comes to get you that lets you know that it's safe. I understand it. But now back to Ghost. I really had never believed so much in Ghost. I'd listened to those stories, and I had seen things, but I never looked at it as a ghost. Then after the second near-death experience in 1989, I would go into VAs and I would go into hospice programs, and then I was really entrenched in AIDS because I could see that people with AIDS really had a lot of problems. It was not only that you were dying a slow and horrendous death, it was that you were an outcast and that you had nowhere to turn and your families would betray you and they wouldn't come see you. And it was just the most horrible way that I could see for a human being to die. I would see beings around these AIDS patients. And I would see people in the hallways. I would see them, but I would never put it as a ghost. But then in 1997, when I had the third near-death experience, which was brain surgery, and then a massive grand mal seizure, and they put me in the neurocardiac ward on life support, that I began to understand that there was a realm where ghosts live. And in The Secrets of the Light, I call it the fertile void. The first two times when I lifted out of my body, Scott and Tom, mm-hmm. I was in a place where I could see the world below me that I'd lived in. And I could see and sense the world that I was going to travel to. And I call this the blue-gray place. the first two times, I thought I was the only person there. Okay, I thought I was the only person there. The third time, I could tell that this was a realm of consciousness within itself. And I don't rarely talk about this, but because I don't want people to get scared and think they all go into hell. But, you know, about 3% of all near-death experiences, people have hellish experiences. And as I listen to those experiences, I can usually understand 1.5% of that 3%, maybe 2.5%. There's a 0.5% I don't understand. But in this blue-gray place, the Catholics call it purgatory, Bodha. It has like 10 names in different cultures. But it's a place you go when you choose not to go down the tunnel into the light. It is by your own choosing, not by any other choice but yours, that you stay in this place. Well, because you like being a prick, or you like being in control and domineering, or because you feel like that you have so ruined your life or so concocted such a consciousness that you don't feel like you deserve to go. I saw a lot of veterans there, a lot of people who felt betrayed in service to their country from many, 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 many wars. I saw women there who thought that what in the name they what they had done and allowed to happen to themselves and their children, that they would remain in this place. That they, in the name of love, what they had let happen is a lot of abuse and a lot of that kind of stuff. So all of a sudden, I had a world that I could clearly define as ghost.
Okay.
That this is where they come from. This is the place that they operate from. I believe that people who do heavy drugs and heavy alcohol, create a vibratory harmonic that from that dimension can move into this dimension. And since the Catholic Church has reported a 700% increase in exorcisms, that more people are beginning to open themselves up to that particularly energetic pattern. So I like ghosts. I like for them to know that they're loved and appreciated. I like for them to make a decision, no matter what has happened to them, that they let go and go down that tunnel and return to the source. And as we hunt them and as we venerate them and as we even wonder, and we have videos of ghosts.
TV shows, yeah.
Yeah, TV shows, but you know, a lot of that's just reality shows.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the paranormal activity that some kid made for $7.40, but it scares the crap out of people. Do I believe there is ghosts? Absolutely. Do I believe that there are poltergeists? Absolutely. Do I believe that there are doppelgangers? Absolutely. Are they mythologies? A lot of mythologies have come up around them. A lot of good, scary stories have come up around them. But do they exist? Yes. Can they let go of the joys of living in this world? No. Or the fear that of letting go to pass into the light? No. So there is a place that people can stay until sooner or later they will let go. But remember, Tom and Scott, it's by choice. I know that was a little long, but
no.
You know, hey, what can I tell you, Bubba?
No, not at all.
It's not. It was actually very intense and very informative, which is what I was trying to get at, not the sugar-coated answer. But, I mean, you've been there, so you're the man to ask.
Exactly, right? Yeah.
And but, what
you know, I'm obsessive-compulsive, so I would have taken the time to study it. I see ghosts all the time. I see them in hospitals. Listen, I'm in the West Los Angeles VA.
I was going to say he's taping from the VA hospital right now.
West Los Angeles, right. In the mental health ward. You cannot ask a single policeman who walks these halls at night checking doors and ask any policeman on the force who's ever been in this building about whether they believe in ghosts or not.
Oh, yeah. Well, because they're troubled souls, right?
So still trapped. This is built in the late 30s. This was before you had the kind of medicine and the kind of treatment. This is when you drugged them or you tied them up or you chained them or you put them in a padded cell. this is that wing. This is probably built in 38. So any place you have that kind of disturbance that never set resolution in place, you're going to create a harmonic that gives those souls in the blue-gray place a sense of safety. They look for a sense of safety or a way to deal with their own actions or to perpetuate resentment. It takes these kind of energies to allow you to hold a vibratory frequency to stay in this blue-gray place. I always thought that when I finally discovered this after three near-death experiences, I always thought maybe they were showing this to me because if I didn't watch out, it would be where I ended up. So you see, I didn't get perfect. You know, it takes about 10 near-death mm-hmm. experiences before I get it right.
Daniel, I want to ask you about the Twilight Brigade. Tell us more about that.
Well, after the 1997, when I saw veterans, and I looked at what was happening to people who come from the same period I came, the Vietnam era, and I watched what was happening to them as they came back from war, and they were never appreciated. I watched what the VA was, the Veterans Hospital, and it was horrible.
Yeah.
Okay, the VA hospital now is probably one of the best, most advanced research facilities in the United States. I see problems in any bureaucracy. I hope that the VA will one day be allowed to fire people, but if you know about the bureaucracy of the federal government, once you have 3 years, you can't be fired unless you murder somebody, and you have to have two verifiable witnesses to you murdering them before you can fire them. Well, it's true. I mean, this is what has to happen. So other than that, I absolutely love the VA. But when I saw this third experience, I had to do something. I had to do something because we are moving into a period of time where we have 2.5 million World War II veterans out of 40 million, 37 million. Yeah. We have 1.9 million Korean veterans. And we have 7.3 million Vietnam-era veterans with about 3.25 million who served in Vietnam. We have a world Desert Storm, and now we have Afghan and Iraq. The Twilight Brigade is a program that's based on the near-death experience that trains and teaches people how to deal with end-of-life care, how to become a caregiver, how to become present, how to be able to help that person who you love or a person who loves you find resolution. So many people have never dealt with death for a lot of reasons. One of the reasons is religion. But even more important than religion is unknown. No one talks about it but we who've had the near-death experience. And then number three, pain. Medicine has advanced so much with its understanding of the molecular and chemical structure of the body, that they can keep you alive longer than you've ever should have been able to stay here. They can keep you alive for years. So we associate death with pain because we have hospitalization. Pneumonia used to be the passing person's best friend. Because you just go to sleep, you cough a little bit, and you go to sleep. Now we have antibiotics. We can fight those naturally closing events, the events that create closure from renal failure, dialysis now exists, from pneumonia, we now have antibiotics. But if someone wants to really know more and more about the Twilight Brigade, Tom, they can go to thetwilightbrigade.com or thetwilightbrigade.org because we have chapters around the country. We have probably close to 6,000 people trained. And if you could look at the emails that come from people who have taken this training, who never knew, who never went to the bedside of a vet, because that's my big kick, but who, tell us about how it helped their mom and their dad, how they were there for their friend or their brother or their sister, and how all the things that they learned, they could constructively use them. So the Twilight Brigade is my gift back. My gift back for losing the fear of death, for seeing the magnificence of the divine, for seeing the greatness of what it is like to be a spiritual being experienced in a human form, and the technique to help people celebrate the fact that you had the right to live here and that someone helps you find a quality and dignity in the life you lived. But so much of the training is just about listening. It's learning how to listen and ask the right questions. And think of this question, Tom and Scott. You got an 88-year-old veteran. He was at the Bataan Death March when we surrendered to the Japanese. He was put in a ship, in the hold of a ship, and sent to Japan, where he worked in a coal mine for 3 years. And now he's sitting in a bed in a VA, and he's 90 years old. What do you say to him? How do you thank him for his service? And when he starts to talk about the punishment and the suffering that he's been through, and he compares it to what he's going through now in a hospital, what do you do? Right. I know what to do. I've been a hospice volunteer for 35 years. I've been in the VA 26 years. I have more than 26,000 hours at the bedside of veterans. I've been with 2,004 veterans as they were leaving this world and 418 taking their last breath. And what I've learned in three journeys from this world to the next and back, I've helped with the really good people create a program that guarantees that you'll be able not only to deal with the fact of your own mortality, you can help those who you love and who love you deal with theirs. And think of this. What would you say to him? I ask him this. What's your favorite song? And all of that. What's your favorite song? Because everybody has one, and it's usually a gospel song. But if you can take a person in that situation and they can go and find their favorite song and you ask them why, you ask them questions about it, then you can take them from that bed all the way back to that time of celebration of happiness. And one guy told me, this guy who I was telling you about, Bataan, it was the national anthem. Because when they freed him and they picked him up, it was playing on the ship that they put him on when he left Japan and that coal mine. They were playing the national anthem. Mm. And he got to tell me that story. He got to tell me that story. When you learn that skill, you're empowered in your life. You're not afraid. You're not afraid. And when you realize that you're a spiritual being, then that's when the change occurs. It happened to me from being dead, okay, and seeing this, and happening over 22 years. But think of this for a moment. I know I'm taking up the whole hour jabbering.
No, it's good.
You think it's pretty good, Tom?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, okay. It is.
Now, think of this. Let's say that you were looking at the physical reality of this earth, atoms. And atoms have cells. And cells have molecules. The physical body is made of atoms, cells, and molecules. It's really molecules, cells, and atoms. If you took all the empty space out of an atom, which is 94.6% empty space, You took all the empty space out of a molecule, which is 99% empty space. And you took all the empty space out of a cell, which is 98% empty space. Every human being on the face of the earth, all 7 billion, would fit on something 1.5 times the size of a sugar cube. That is scientific fact. 1.5 times the size of a sugar cube every person could fit on. If that is a scientific fact, then who the hell are you? You are a spiritual being. The reality is empty space. The value you give what you think are your possessions is a value that you are giving to absolutely nothing but empty space. When you have that as a reality, and you've seen the spiritual dimensions of the other worlds like I have, you have no choice but to change. And I think that's why I do these radio shows. We have to get a grip on reality, because the reality that we are manifesting, they're passing a bill today that declares the United States of America a battleground.
Yep, it's true.
That Posse Comitatus no longer exists, and that Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, Carl Levin of wherever the hell he's from, and John McCain says that anybody could be declared a terrorist and sent to Guantanamo and held indefinitely without ever being charged with a crime or without ever being given access to a lawyer. Well, I think the three of them and every congressman and every senator that voted for that bill should be declared a terrorist and sent to Guantanamo. I believe that anybody votes for the election of anybody who voted for that bill should be declared a terrorist. If we reelect those people to the Congress and to this Congress, and if the President of the United States signs that bill, they should be declared terrorists. It is unconstitutional. The reality that we're allowing to be created because we're thinking human instead of spiritually perceiving and looking for change is destroying us. We deserve it.
Yeah.
But if President Obama signs that bill, I know Lindsey will never get another vote from me, and I will never support John McCain and Levin or any other congressman and senator who voted for that bill. I will campaign against them if I have to. So
yeah.
When you're a spiritual being and you get a little politically radical, you have to look at the values of this: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, not terror. Terror is a political act. It's politics to create fear, to declare the United States a battleground, repeals half of the amendments of the United States Constitution. I am totally against it.
Yeah,
so I not only believe in ghosts, I believe that everybody who voted for that bill are terrorists.
Yeah, and maybe they should be saved by the light.
Well, they just need to spend some time in Guantanamo, and you know what?
Maybe
if we all listen tonight when this show airs and we take a stand, maybe that light can enter their hearts.
Well, that's it exactly. I think with what's going on now, and me and Tom have talked about this on the show, with the Occupy movement is just one of the problems that the people have had, the local police, was when they were questioned about it, they said, what would you usually do in these situations? How do you look after these guys? And he said, well, what we generally do is we find the leader, we bring the leader in, we tell him how it's going to be, and then we release him back into the, we release him back, and then he spreads that information. with the Occupy movement, there doesn't seem to be any leaders. So it's just a consciousness thing. There's over 4,000 cities now, and it's just this consciousness thing. It's just a reflection. I've said this before. It's a reflection of the French Revolution of the 60s. You know, I've said before, if we had the internet in the 60s, it'd be all over by now. You know?
Yeah, well, that's exactly what it is. For we who lived in the 60s, it all culminated in the Vietnam War. But it started out exactly what you're seeing now. It's exactly what we're seeing now. This is what's going to happen. They will never be able to stop it. If we call it Occupy, well, what do they call the Arab Spring? How are you going to bring a bunch of people, take it to the street because the economic system has collapsed, the political system has collapsed, the legal system has collapsed, the banking system has collapsed, the institutions has collapsed, and religion has collapsed. You have nothing you can trust. And so there is no way when you see this bill being passed, it's a precursor. They know civil unrest is coming. They know it's coming because those who sit in political office, they see the storm coming, and they have to prepare. This bill tells us that it's going to get worse, and they have to prepare to be able to create a terrorist. I read a report. Now, I can't say that this is factual, but it came from some friends of mine who still work in the government who I knew a long, long time ago, and they're just trying to make retirement. But they said that Homeland Security and the FBI are teaching local police to regard anyone who has served in the military who has done more than two tours in Afghanistan and Iraq as a potential domestic terrorist. And I said, well, why in the world would that? Why in the world? And he said, it's very easy. They know what really happened. They know what really happened. They know about private armies. They know about contractors. They know about secret police forces. And they know about what happened. And they are coming back into a country that has no jobs, that has no respect for them. And they went and fought for this. And they went and risked their lives and lost their best friends and saw stuff happen. And they come home. They see clearly that it's happening to America, what they went to war to protect and defend. They clearly see it happening to us. Now, when I heard that, Tom and Scott, I thought for a moment, that's pretty scary. Oh, and that you have to pass a bill. And when you look at what's happening, when these guys get home, they're political savvy. They're social networking. They're computer smart. They can tweet. They can email. They can research. So the next thing will come.
And they're not too bad with guns either.
Well, we taught them how to take guns. I don't like to say that.
Yeah.
Okay, because I believe that the voice is power. The pen is more powerful than the sword. And I am not against war. I'm just for peace. I am for peace. But you know what's going to happen? I promise you can bet on this. We will have soon military against military. These guys are going to come home. The bureaucracy does not care about a guy. You hear it every day. Veterans who fight for years to get their disability. Look at Agent Orange. Look at Desert Storm Syndrome.
Yeah, Gulf War Syndrome. Yeah, they didn't care.
Depleted uranium. We know what caused it. Look what they did. It took 30 years to get disability from Agent Orange when they knew the whole time what it is. These guys know. They're not Vietnam. Okay? Vietnam have become educated. There's been a 58% increase in PTSD among Vietnam veterans. Why? A Vietnam veteran becomes some kind of holic, workaholic, alcoholic, a drug addict, because they see what happened. Look at me lie. They see what happened. Now think about that. When you come home and you're hypervigilant, and what I don't understand is the government doesn't see the same thing that happened in the NAM. number one, you have no rear echelon. You have no border. Numberless is the green zone. Same as Vietnam. Number two, your fire base. It was the bees would come in, dig a hole, put some tin on it, cover with dirt, and put enough a white phosphorus or napalm and Agent Orange to burn you a space in the middle of a jungle that you can't see a foot in front of you. You don't know who your enemy is because they were Viet Cong, the same as these are Taliban and Al Qaeda, quote unquote. You don't know who your enemy is, so you become hyper vigilant. You don't sleep. Well, these same guys who were rolling back from theater in Afghanistan and Iraq, they don't know who their enemy is. They have no safe. There is no rear echelon. They become hypervigilant. They're trigger happy. Do you notice that the increase in veteran automobile accidents? If you are a veteran and you come back to the United States, you have a 50% increase in automobile accidents among veterans. And when a veteran goes to get insurance, and they say that they're a veteran, look at the rates that they're charged based on that information. I live in this world, guys. I live among these people because I am them.
Yeah.
I see them on a daily basis. I make rounds and I listen. It doesn't make me less spiritual. It makes me more spiritual. It makes me more determined to open people's hearts to the Panoramic Life Review.
Right.
Sure. You know, if God couldn't come today and God sent me in the life I will review, and what difference did God make? That no vet dies alone. That I will talk and I will recruit and I will send people to the Twilight Brigade. I will fight for those people's rights to come and take this training. I will fight for people to be at the bedside of veterans, and I will fight as hard as I can. But it is my voice and my words that I use as a weapon. You know, I am against nothing. I'm only for things. I'm never going to be against war. I'm only just going to be for peace. But this time is getting ready to come.
Yeah, I was gonna ask, do you notice a difference now? Do you think that it's a catchy term that people are waking up, but, you know, maybe it's appropriate.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Remember, this is a natural process. This, just like you said, it happened in the 1890s. It happened in the 1920s. You know, people try to figure out where flower power came from. Flower power, we think, came in the 60s. It wasn't. It was started in Germany in 1928 after the Treaty of Versailles that ended World War I. The Germans... because of the punishment the British and the French and Belgium and what the Germans did, they created the Treaty of Versailles. It was meant to punish the Germans, and the Germans put flowers in the rifles of the Wehrmacht under Kaiser Wilhelm, and that's where flower power came, and it began in the 60s. This evolution is happening. People are waking up. And then if you take it a little into cosmology and you look at the Mayans, the Mayan calendar, we're going from the galactic period to the universal period. And what the Mayas say is that all day in the last 5,000 years, 5,125 years, all things done out of integrity, and especially in this last 125-year period, all things not done in integrity will collapse. Okay? As we move from the ninth wave from a Mayan term. Well, our religions, our institutions, our banks, our governments, everything has collapsed. There is nothing people can trust. And so as we move into the universal period, this would naturally happen. We would awaken. People are not going to take it. They're just not going to take it. And no matter how many laws they pass, everything that they do just keeps uniting us.
Yeah.
So I believe that
we're going to keep on coming.
I believe that it's the greatest time ever to live. I love this. I'm excited about the end of time and the beginning of a new period.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Me and Tom have talked about this. I don't know if on 2012, December 21st, 2012, if something's going to magically change, but I think that there's I think it's a process. That's what I think.
Well, I think the change is already happening. You know, it's a progression that's been going on over the last dozen or so years. Remember,
last
I've been saying
51.
That for a long time.
The last 51 years. If you look at the Maya, everybody looks at the Mayan calendar from the 365-day calendar. That's not the calendar. We say that because the Mayas that were astrophysicists. They invented the zero. Where would Bill Gates be without the Mayans? Okay. And why did they invent the zero? So they could determine where Venus was. Why? Because the Mayans believed they came from Venus. Okay, but the real calendar is what the Spanish call the agrarian calendar, because there's three major calendars in the Maya. And it's the 240-day calendar, but the Spanish decided it was the agrarian calendar, or their 13-month calendar to plan. The Mayas measured consciousness. Okay, if you look at Maya, December the 21st, 2012 doesn't mean anything to a Mayan. It was the end of the period and the phasing beginning of the next period. If you look at it from a concept as an astrophysicist, it takes 25,920 years to move for our solar system to make a progression through our galaxy that we call the Milky Way of 1.1 billion planets and stars from the outer edge to the inner edge of the solar of the galaxy, which if you ever looked at our galaxy from a photograph, you see it's really oblong and it's vacant in the center. So that means that our little sun, our little dwarf star, and when you look at our sun and you realize that you can put the next size sun or star in our galaxy, you can put 1,000 of our stars, of our sun, in the next largest size star in our galaxy. 1,000 of them. We are a dwarf star. It takes 25,920 years for us to move to the center. But our galaxy, in what you call the equinox or the constellational pattern, it takes that many years. As our solar system moves from the outer edge to the inner edge, it is also making a movement through the constellations, or from the Piscean age to the Aquarian age to Capricorn, all that mumbo-jumbo we heard in the 60s. But this is astrophysics. This is not some kind of quantitative hoodoo. We are scientifically knowledgeable that this progression exists. No one puts those two concepts together to realize that we are moving from not only from the outer edge of our planetary galaxy to the inner edge, which is called cosmic waves of energy in the mythologies. They call the cosmic waves. Okay, and it was all mythology. But think about it. Why is it flooding everywhere in the world? Why is there so many floods? Well, they know now. Cosmic waves of mythology can now be measured in neutrinos and tachyons. There are new cloud formations being created by measuring a neutrino, which is a subatomic particle, and a tachyon, which is a subatomic particle. But we can now measure them. And when you're looking at these neutrinos in these cloud formations, they hold more moisture. Because there is, from what the Mayas call the galactic center, there is a movement of energy that is passing that is unimpeded and affecting our solar, our universe, or our solar system. That's number one. Then number two, solar flares. We are hitting the end of a 12-year cycle of solar flares. Yep. We are seeing eruptions of solar flares in this last 2 or 3 months. from 10 years of a quiet period of time. We had a solar flare in 2007 or 8 that if it had been 4 more degrees or 5 more degrees, like southwest, I don't know how you would quite determine it, but we wouldn't exist anymore. Neither would Mars, neither would Venus, neither would Neptune. It would have been the cosmic flux of that blast of a solar flare would have wiped it out. Now, when you start to really look at that from an astrophysicist's point of view, you see the potential for something dramatic to happen. Then you start looking at people who do and pay attention to that, which would be NASA, and then the CIA, the NSA, the National Reconnaissance Agency, and you start looking at that. Then you see them realizing and putting satellites, they're launching satellites left and right because they have to shield these cosmic waves that are coming from solar flares. The British and the Americans have already worked in conjunction, I think, with the Russians and the Chinese to launch a series of satellites to make sure no solar flare messes up the broadcast of the 2012 London Olympics. Now, if you think about that for a minute, to know that they put all that technology so that they can broadcast the Olympics, thinking that they're going to be solar flares, now what do you think and how do you think they would have come to that conclusion? So when you talk about next year in 2012, it doesn't mean anything to the Mayans. It means a period is ended and a new period is begun. It's the same as December the 31st and January the 1st. It's a new year.
Right.
Okay, there's no difference. Okay, but everybody, you know, you get a bunch of white people interpreting a bunch of Mesoamerican mythology, and then you figure out a way to scare people because it was 2000 and the computers weren't going to roll over. And then you can sell a lot of food, you know. You can sell a lot of stored up food and get you some, sell some flashlights and stuff.
You know, when it comes right down to it, you're not getting out of this life alive.
Oh, yeah, you are. When it gets down to it, you know, I always say, well, what are they going to do, kill me? Well, golly, how afraid of that can you possibly get?
That's my point. I mean, if there is a solar flare that wipes out the planet, okay.
Party on.
Yeah, bring it. Let's go. I mean, galaxies collide. You know?
Universes collide.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's life forms there, in my opinion.
Your opinion is absolutely correct.
That there's all kinds of life forms out there.
How can anybody think for a moment? Look. You look at the Galileo. Look at the Galileo telescope. You look at the Hubble telescope. You look at the survey that spanned the universe and did, like, there were gamma radio scopes and the SETI deal to determine the size of the universe. Think of this. They estimated that there was 101 billion universes, 101 billion galaxies, averaging between 1 billion to 10 billion planets and stars. Yeah. If you add that all up, it comes to like 10 trillion planets and stars. 10 trillion. You ask any mathematician what the theoretical probability based on 10 trillion other possibly inhabitable planets and stars, solar systems, not stars, because you'd have to get a good tan to live on a star. But who the hell, who knows? If you ask any theoretical, if you ask any mathematician, what is the theoretical probability that we are the only ones here based on that scientific evidence, it would be impossible for us to be alone. It's mathematically impossible for us to be alone.
Now, I was going to say that we're saying we're the one. You know, there is nothing else out there bigger than us. We are it.
Yeah. Well, that means that all that empty space I was talking about earlier is in the heads of those people who think that. Because when you realize, think of this. Think about this. I mean, let me say it again. If you take all the empty space out of all the cells, all the molecules, and all the atoms, just the empty space, 7 billion people matter, what you call matter, 7 billion people could fit into something 1.5 times the size of a sugar cube. That is a scientific fact. The moment that you grip that, if you don't change your psychological observation of reality, you are a damn fool. Now, it may have taken me to die 2 or 3 times for me to get to this place, but I'm here. I am here.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, and once you're there, you look at the possible probabilities. I not only believe that they're extraterrestrial, although I have never seen a UFO. I have never seen one. I have never seen a spaceman. And the only reason, since I'm from South Carolina and I'm a big NASCAR fan, the only reason I hope to see a UFO is they'll stop and let me drive it.
Yeah.
I want to see what it'll do in a quarter light year. Where is the gas pedal on this SOB?
Damn thing.
The next thing I want to know is, how much gasoline does this bastard hold to come 90 million miles?
Yeah.
Exactly. And where are you keeping it?
Yeah. I mean, think about it. If you believed in fossil fuel and burning coal as a source of power, which is what we do, we burn up wood, we burn up coal, we have a little nuclear power, and what a nuclear power does is it's a steam. Only thing a nuclear power plant does is heat water. It doesn't do anything else but heat water.
Yep.
Okay? And you burn oil, which is supposed to be fossil fuel, which means that it's made from all the vegetation that the earth was in the Neopaleolithic period 200 billion years ago, and there's a limited amount of it. Well, we already know that none of that's true. We already know that the earth produces that stuff somewhere in the mantle, and the largest supplies of that stuff is in the Gulf of Mexico and off of Brazil and off of the South American coast. We already know that. Okay, so if you believe that, I wouldn't want anybody to know that there was a UFO. I wouldn't want them to know, and why?
Right.
Cost too much money.
Yep.
Right, because they're wondering, hold on a minute. If they're not using coal, and if they're not using oil, and if they're not using nuclear power, how is it they're getting around? And where do we get a piece of that? Yeah, that would be it exactly.
There you go. Now you're starting to catch on to how come they quit talking about it. How come you have right now, look at how many colonels, look at how many captains, look at how many airline pilots who were fighter pilots who became airline pilots who have witnessed UFOs. Why do they not talk about it? Because you destroy their reputation. Okay? You know, when you hear a guy see something come past him and he can look at it and it flies by, stops, cruises along beside you and can make a estimated amount of 9,000 miles an hour and make a right turn, make a 90-degree right turn, give me a break. And we've been hearing about this stuff. Look at the stuff of Jim Mars. Just go look up Jim Mars and read some of that crap Jim Mars writes about.
Yeah.
And you get it. Who in the world? They won't be able to keep it from us long. It won't be able to keep it from us. Okay? And do they make deals with these people and all that stuff? I don't know. But like what I was saying, do I believe that there are extraterrestrial beings? It's theoretically impossible for them not to be there. Do I believe there are interdimensional realities and beings? Absolutely. Why? Because I have been there. I've been in interdimensional realms. I have seen interdimensional beings and creatures. I don't say creatures, but because they were of a design I didn't understand, or a design that I could never put into a...
Non-humans?
Oh.
Like the non-human shape is what you're saying.
Right. Entities.
Okay.
I have seen them.
You seem like what would be the popular gray alien?
I've never seen one of those.
Okay.
I mean, but I have seen beings, entities, as Heidi says. But I have seen them, and I've seen dimensional reality.
Right.
You know, we live in dimensions. Look at quantum physics, or it's not really quantum physics. Somebody made that word up. It's really particle physics, and if you look at the concept of particle physics in the multidimensional reality, Planck, a German in 1801, developed this theory that a photon, that light can be both energy and matter at the same time because of measuring photons and electrons. It can be both. And then a guy named Deutsch, an Englishman, advanced the theory of the multi-universe theory, and he has concluded that we are occupying simultaneously between 11 and 17 simultaneous realities. Well, the first thing I thought when I heard that theory was, at least now I know why I'm so tired when I wake up in the morning. Because if I'm having half as much fun in those realities as I'm having in this reality, no wonder I'm tired.
Never mind. Yeah, the other morning I got up and, you know, I was dreaming that I was doing some work and it was hurting my back, and I woke up in the morning, my back was hurting.
Well, I think it serves you right. See, we have to find a place where spirituality, and I have a saying, I mean, it's a southern, it's still another Danianism. When people start getting really serious, especially when they start talking religion, I always say this: if it's not funny, it's not spiritual. Yeah. And if you're going to talk to me about something spiritual and you're not making me laugh, you can take it on with you. Because the world that I have seen after this one, I can't wait to get back there. But I also know, based on the panoramic life review, that I made a deal to come here. And I was chosen to come, and I chose to come. But I was chosen. That the divine architect believes, and this is every person on this earth, the divine architect believes that there is no one better than you to be born at the exact moment, at the exact place that you were born, to achieve the unfoldment of the universe. Now, maybe when he was thinking about all those people who voted for this bill that makes America a battle zone, you know, maybe he was, you know, he had just invented grapes. You know, maybe God had just invented Napa Valley when he decided to let those people be born, you know, and he had discovered fermentation. But when you think about it and you start to put into focus that you fit on a sugar cube, and all you are is energy, your energy. And what's going to be the revolution of consciousness is when we move from a chemical reality, which is where we live now. We first lived in physical matter, Newtonian mechanics, physical reality. Then we moved to physics, which is dominated by chemistry. And we have pharmaceutical companies that now are God. There's only three gods: drugs, gold, and oil.
Yeah.
There's only three gods. We live in a chemical reality, but we are migrating into an energetic reality. In the last year, science says there is no such thing as matter. Matter is a vibratory reflection of an energetic platform. Okay, well, now, here's the big point. When a pharmaceutical company has to explain energetically how a pill works in the body, since the body is all energy, a revolution begins.
Right.
Number two, if you go back, and I always hold this stuff back, Scott and Tom, because, you know, I like to stir it up. But if you look at the patents, the weather patents from 1964, in 1964, a man working for the Johnson administration put a series of 8 patents that weaponized weather. We now call it HAARP.
Yeah.
But it's only using frequencies to affect not currents, what we call currents, what we call the trade winds and the tidal currents and the Gulf Stream, but to set a frequency at a constant that changes global weather patterns. The Chinese use this to keep China, keep Beijing clear so they could have the Olympics. The Russians have recently said they have a weapon that can kill 120 million people. The weather is weaponized. Yeah. We heard for years about chemtrails. The government last month admitted that they have been spreading barium salts with compound agents in the sky. They're not trying to deny it, although they denied it for 20 years. Well, what are those compounds that they're putting in the atmosphere with those barium salts? And what is the energetic frequency that they're atomatizing that salt with in the atmosphere to achieve what goal? They don't answer that. But now they've been busted because some colonel got on a plane to fly it, and he saw a 757 outfitted with these tanks. And he took pictures of it with his cell phone. He pictured the airplane, where it was. He pictured the seats being removed and the tanks. And he flew the plane. And he put that stuff up on YouTube. Go look at chemtrails on YouTube and look at what you see and let them deny it.
Yeah.
These are exciting times because we are beginning to realize we are beautiful, energetic, spiritual beings. And that's who we are.
It does seem a little bit of an unveiling happening. The time period between things being done and the masses finding out that they're being screwed seems to be less and less and less and less.
The Mayans call it the universal period. The book of Revelation of John said there'll come a time when the Antichrist can speak to the whole world. Well, guess what? That's today.
Yeah.
Hello.
There you go.
Yeah, but people are picking up on it quicker now. You know, there used to be the 30-year-long conspiracies, 50-year-long conspiracies. Now somebody does something, and 2 weeks later, there's a YouTube video on it.
Thank you, God.
And 3 million people have watched it.
But you see, this is the point, the universal period. There are no secrets. I mean, there are no secrets. I mean, I love to read all the stuff people say about me. I have the best time. Somebody asked me, they said, Daniel, why don't you ever, like, defend yourself? Well, I do sometimes. Then they have this place where they go and they check my records and they go and they come up with this all this stuff about who I am and where I've been and where I haven't been and what I haven't done. And you know what? What's exciting is this. If they knew the truth, they couldn't handle it. And, you know, you have to be careful because if you've ever worked in theaters of operation, let's say, you have an obligation to protect those people who didn't have a near-death experience. You have an obligation to protect those people who are in their 50s, late 50s and 60s. Who served along with you. And anybody who believes that Blackwater and private government operations and doesn't go on and didn't happen, that's an idiot anyway. But a friend of mine asked me the other day, they said, Daniel, have you been to that religious site that's got Daniel something? I said, sure. He said, do you read some of the stuff that people say about you in the comments? I said, yeah. And then I told him, I said, did you read what, and I'm not going to tell you who it is. I said, did you read what the name, the code name that the person said? He said, yeah, that was a vicious attack. I said, well, let me tell you, that was me. I write most of that stuff just to start crap.
You get in there and viciously attack yourself.
Yeah. I'm the one who writes most of that stuff. Come on, you know what? If you know you're not going to die, and you know you're not going to hell, and you're a hospice volunteer at the VA, and you've been doing it for 35 years, I've been a hospice volunteer, and I've been a hospice volunteer in the VA for 26 years, and I'm in the VA right now, and I'm sitting here with two volunteers, and we will make rounds. Will is going to make rounds. He's a former Marine who is a, he's making a face. He's a former Marine in Desert Storm and Iraq. He's also an EMT. Heidi is the COO of the Twilight Brigade. She, like, runs the thing. And we're sitting here working. And right. And we'll make rounds tonight. And it's like 8 or 9 o'clock our time. But we'll make rounds tonight. And I don't care what people say about me, as long as they're having a good time.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. You know, the thing is, your story has been around a long time. And you put a lot of time and your personal effort into helping people dying. I don't know. That's like kicking a puppy or something. I don't know.
Yeah, but you know what? But listen, though, guys. Come on. I had a near-death experience when it didn't have a name.
Yeah.
Raymond Moody, who coined the term NDE, was going to medical school at the hospital they brought me to. The University of Georgia Medical School. Raymond was a student going to medical school. So I am synonymous with the work of Raymond Moody because Raymond and I became great friends. And I was a defender of Raymond. Raymond caught a lot of hell because he was just a good scientist, and he was a PhD in philosophy who decided to become a forensic psychiatrist. And he started asking patients while he was a medical student, because you know what they do to an intern.
Yeah,
they work the crap out of you. And he started asking, and he got involved in this near-death experience business, and I came along. I didn't know what it was. But it took me 2 years to learn to walk and feed myself, and another 2 years before I got a grip on it. But I had this happen to me. Before it had a name. I hear so many people describe near-death experiences. Well, mostly I ask them, what did you do for the next 6 months after you had it? And how has it affected your life? Because that's how you tell. I mean, mine have been dramatic instances. Struck by lightning, dead for 28 minutes, completely paralyzed for 6 days, partially paralyzed for 7 months, 2 years to learn to walk and feed myself, open heart surgery, and 9 months under critical care. At 14 years later, I got struck by lightning. It didn't kill me, so I don't even really count that. Just knocked me unconscious for 45 minutes. And then at 49 years old, or 47 years old, having open heart surgery, having brain surgery, and they were going to have to do open heart surgery at the same time, and they gave me like an 8% chance of surviving. I didn't survive. I had a massive grand mal seizure and went to cardiac arrest and was put in a neurocardiac ward on life support. And I am still a hospice volunteer.
Right.
So everybody can talk about me and say what they want and they can write about it. And this is the fun part. I don't care.
Yeah. Exactly. It's like... You know what? With what I've been through, if that what makes you feel good, you need to talk about that. Knock yourself out. Go
Party
for it.
Party on, you know.
Party on, boys.
Yeah, and I stir it up out there. I don't care. What are they going to do? Kill me? Well, big deal. And listen.
Been there, done that, eh?
Yep.
Say this, though. I appreciate you guys doing this show. I mean, I appreciate it because it's two guys coming together and informing people.
Yeah.
Giving people the opportunity to hear fools like me, but giving people the opportunity. No one should fear death. It does not happen.
Yep.
And once you try to put that in your context, and you look at the basic science, it is so possible for you to see your spiritual self and to open up to the potential of who you are and what the possibilities are of why you are here. Where did you come? People say, well, this is hell. I was sent here to be punished. That's a fool talking. You were sent here to be a co-creator, to take the energetics and to form realities and to make the world a better place and to empower people and to inspire people. I have a saying, aspire to inspire before you expire.
Perfect.
And if you take that's what this new book, I hope everybody that hears this goes to Danyon.com. And the Twilight Brigade, because if you go to Danyon, all you're going to do is go to the Twilight Brigade.
Yeah.
And look at the books. Look at Saved by the Light. Look at Peace in the Light. Look at the Secrets of the Light, because it's a 35-year journey of one person who started out as bad as they get, who's still basically a jerk. I had a radio show. This lady came up and she said, Danyon, I want to ask Mr. Danyon, I want to ask you a question. She said, you know, you seem to have like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde personality. And this is what Art used to always accuse me of, because he used to tell me I was a jackass. And he said, well, because, you know, I don't care. If they didn't get me those last three times, if I didn't go to hell those last three times, they missed their chance at me.
So, there you go.
and so she said, why did you think you were chosen? I said, well, I believe this. God had completely run out of messiahs. And they were scraping the bottom of the barrel. And they said, let's go find us a jackass. And let's pile this stuff off on him and see how he handles it. Ta-da!
And here I am. And here's Dan.
You know? And so the lady, she said, I said, well, I created an organization called JAA. And I said, it's a lot like Alcoholics Anonymous. You just go one day at a time. And she said, what does JAA stand for? I said, Jackasses Anonymous. And I said, so far today, I haven't been bad to anybody. And then I said, you know what makes me happy about that, lady? And she says, no, what? I said, the day's still young.
It's not over yet.
Yeah, sugar.
Honey bun. Okay, I think we've taken enough of your time. I know that you have to do your rounds at the VA hospital. So what I'd like you to do is, could you just please quickly give your websites and the name of your new book and when it's coming out? And if you're doing if you've got any upcoming lectures, could you mention those as well?
Well, that'll be on Danyon.com. Everything about me is on Danyon, Danyon.com.
Okay.
And thetwilightbrigade.com.
Okay.
I'm running the 11/11 campaign till the end of this month, and I'm asking people, since we had 11/11/11, an event that comes once every 100 years, to send me 11 cents or $11 or $1,000 or $1,100. I had Terry Fader send me $11,111. He is a headliner. He's the largest attraction on the Las Vegas Strip. And he heard me on a radio show, and he called in on Coast to Coast with George Norrie, and he donated $11,111.11.
Oh, that's That's brilliant.
Great. I mean, you know, and a lot of people are coming to the plate. I got a lot of $11 donations. And it's tax deductible. I'm a 501, tax 501, 3C nonprofit.
Yeah.
I only operate. There are no paid employees.
Yeah.
And this money just goes toward training and putting people in the field to be at the bedside of veterans, but really reducing the fear of death.
Yes.
Danyon starts on January the 1st. I'll start writing again, That Ain't Nothing, which is my blog.
Right.
And it's me, just like me, attacking this new bill that if Obama signs it with making every American a potential
terrorist.
And if you've done more than two tours, you're considered a domestic terrorist already.
This is
going to come back to haunt them.
Oh, yeah.
And this is where you draw the line in the sand. I can't wait to hear what Ron Paul says about it.
Yeah. It's like the mass of humanity is a lion, and they just keep, the elite just keeps sneaking up behind and poking us in the ass, waiting.
Well, hoping we still fall for it.
Yeah.
But we're not. I mean, look at what we're doing. We can talk openly, and my program is about death. But what I like to do a show is because you two guys are real. I'm a real person. Yeah. You know, I'm not some swami, or I call it the swami business. I'm a real down-to-earth person, and being a hospice volunteer makes you a real down-to-earth person. I don't read my press releases, and I don't read all that stuff that people say about me, although it is, some of it's pretty cool.
Right, especially the stuff you write.
Yeah, man. But I attack me. I have the best time because once I attack me, I like to read all the stuff that people say after it. And most, but it's really fun because it's amazing how people come to my defense. It's amazing. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I rip me to shreds. And the next hundred chats are people tearing in, you know, attacking me for attacking me. And I think, you know, they don't really know that it's me. But it
sounds like a lot of fun.
It's a joy that millions and millions and millions and millions of people have heard about me, who support me, and that they find a part of themselves in me. We're not perfect, and we're not designed to be perfect. But what we're designed to do is to make a difference and to find something of service, to find something that you can give that makes your life have value. Hospice is mine. It could be Meals on Wheels. It could be child abuse. It could be animal rights. It could be
stopping children. The vaccines.
It could be, well, I don't, I have to, I believe that anything that has mercury in it is not good for you.
Yeah.
But I am not scientifically qualified. I know we have a person, Beth Clay, who is a Twilight Brigader, who's an expert in vaccines and autism.
Yeah, we've talked to, you know, quite a few people on our show that are experts in the field, and they say it's, you know, definitely somewhat dangerous. Avoid it if humanly possible.
Go to Beth Clay go to Beth at BethClay.com.
Okay.
Wait a minute, what is it?
It's just BethClay.com.
Go to BethClay.com.
Okay.
And get Beth Clay on.
I will. 100%.
Beth is an expert.
Okay.
And she worked for the House Oversight and Reform Committee. And she studied this for 20 years, and she knows, and you can't argue with the science.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I like to have experts on, because, you know, what do I know? I have people on that have spent their lives studying things. You just happen to have spent your life dying repeatedly. So I'm going to learn about death. I know. Let's talk to Danyon.
Yeah. Well, no, it makes me proud. Look, I'm proud that you talk to me, and I'm really proud that you guys take your time to do this show, you know, to do this show and to put it together and to, you know, you can, you know, fix it any way you want.
Yeah.
And I'm happy. So I am thankful to everybody. I hope they aspire to inspire before they expire.
Yeah.
I wish everyone who's listening to this show, please, as you are awakening, take action. And please call and write your congressman and your senator and House of Representatives and your senator and demand that that bill I hope he doesn't sign it, but that bill is repealed to make every American a possible domestic terrorist, creates a way that any of us who stands up against tyranny, they have a place in Guantanamo for us.
Yeah, that's scary. And if you speak out, if you say anything against the government, like we're doing now, would qualify us as a terrorist. Yeah.
That's exactly what the language says, Scott and Tom. If you read the language in that bill, because most law terms come from Black's Dictionary. Most legal terms come from what's called Black's Dictionary. If you read those terms, us having this conversation, we could be considered domestic terrorists because we are standing up. And my last point, the FBI, I saw a video on YouTube about an FBI training session with local police. And the FBI agent asked, who were the original domestic terrorists in the United States? And everybody was sitting there thinking, and no one had an answer, and the FBI agent said, the Founding Fathers.
Yep.
So the FBI is going around teaching police that the original domestic terrorists were the Founding Fathers who rebelled against the King of England, and that when you get to that point, when that's it, all of us are domestic terrorists.
Yeah, that's crazy. Well, I'd like to thank you for coming. Thank you for your time. And
I'm sorry I bored you for 2 hours, but you know.
Oh, heck no.
No.
This was fun.
Take it like men.
Yeah.
No, I love it. Like I said, our show is just a conversation. It's just a couple of, people getting together and having a conversation. So we're trading information back and forth, and I think it's great. And I really want to thank you for your time. And thank you very much.
And Scott, be sure to tell your wife that I love her even more and that she has excellent taste in men now, and I'm an authority.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
And Tom, thank you. And guys, thanks for having me. Be blessed, be safe, and happy holidays.
Bless.
Thanks. And we'll see you guys next week.
Bye-bye. I look forward to it.